This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, tap languages' knees with a little hammer. In this episode, we're talking about the First Nations languages of Australia, of which there were a lot. Then there were not. English language, the problematic fave, strikes again. Some of the languages have been wiped out, some have only a handful of speakers left, but some are in a healthier state. Content note, violence and genocide. On with the show.
Yama, Rudi Brema Ngaya, Gamilaroi Ngaya Inar. So, hi, I'm Rudi Brema, and I'm a Gamilaroi woman. I'm a Murray woman from Gamilaroi country. I grew up in Sydney. I speak a little bit of Gamilaroi, which is my language, although not as much as I'd like. And a lot of my words they're things I learn in, like, as a kid, so they're not for polite company.
Interesting. Tell me more.
My mom has these stories about when my brother and I were really small, if people outside of our family babysat us, they would be really confused when, you know, we would ask for ngamu, because, like, we're meaning, like, breast milk. Ngamu means boob. And so it's I'm hungry. And they'd be like, I don't know what that is. I don't know what this child is saying at me. We might also maybe flag that we needed to go to the Jilawa, you know, because we needed to gil or to guna.
I'm understanding these from context.
Yeah, so you get it from context, although this is an adult sort of providing some context.
That is true.
The kid is just saying it at you. You're just like, I don't really know what you want to do.
And then about 30 seconds later, you might realize.
You're like,
whoops.
Missed it. Yep.
And how much do you use the language now as an adult?
Not a whole lot. I guess a big part of that would be the fact that I don't know many other people that speak my language that I see on kind of a day-to-day basis. Yeah, like I might use some of those words about like going to the Jilawa, but like that's around other Aboriginal people who it's a word that's sort of spread across a good chunk of Australia. Like it's a word that you can just kind of use.
Jilawa.
Yeah. And a lot of Aboriginal people will know it doesn't matter whether they're New South Wales or Victoria or like they're with you on it.
Right. And that's useful because that is a bodily function that everyone has to use.
Yes. Eventually everyone's going to go to the toilet. So yeah. They're going to go to the Jilawa. Yeah.
It's the great universal.
Mm. I've mentioned I'm a Gamilaroi person. There's areas on my country, which is northwest New South Wales, and there's sites that are very definitely known as massacre sites for my people. It's not the only cliff in Australia that would have this name, but there is a cliff on my country called Jin's Leap. And Jin is a derogatory term that was used for Aboriginal women. And so that cliff is actually a site where Aboriginal people, but predominantly the women and children, were driven kind of to the point where their choice was to be killed where they stood or to jump and die.
With place names like that, is there some controversy about them still being called that? Or is the thought that, like, you should keep that name to recognise this terrible thing that was done?
Yeah, there's definitely controversy in the fact that, like, I mean, I mentioned that Jin is a derogatory term for Aboriginal women, but it's also such an archaic term that, like, there is a good chunk of Australia that wouldn't actually know that that's a term in and of itself. Which is really bizarre, because there was a certain amount of reclamation that happened around that term. And so you will hear Aboriginal women, and I'll admit I'm one of them, who will occasionally refer to themselves and their friends as Jins. And that's fine. But people don't necessarily understand, like, what it's in reference to, and that it's a reclamation and that it was a bad term. And definitely would continue to be a bad term if it was someone not Aboriginal saying it.
My name's Karina Lester. I'm a Yangunjara woman from the Yarnungal Binyanyara Yangunjara lands, but I also work at the University of Adelaide And I work for a team called the Mobile Language Team as a co-manager and senior Aboriginal language worker, working on supporting our Aboriginal languages across the state of South Australia, whether it's language revival, language reclamation, or language maintenance.
English is currently the most commonly spoken language in Australia. But before Europeans got to Australia, the Dutch arriving in 1606, then the British claiming land in 1770, a lot of different languages existed in the lands.
Many, thousands. They are languages that are from those lands. And you look at a Horton map or an IATSIS map, you see an interpretation, again by a non-Aboriginal person, but you see these very colourful map that has colours for every language group, and that gives you some indication visually of the number of languages that was spoken prior to contact. So there were thousands of languages. Dialects are what linguists have put in to our thinking, our Indigenous thinking, because dialects are languages that have similarity in grammar structure and similarities in the way languages use. So they call them as dialects, but they are languages. To speakers, to oral speakers, they are languages because they associate with that particular language.
Yeah, and so a lot of languages have typically around 6 to 8 distinct dialects. One of the things about colonization is that there are certain language groups where those dialects have either been kind of homogenized and pulled into just one sort of large language group, or maybe a few of the dialects have kind of been lost.
Today, you know, we're looking at a very, low number of languages in Australia. So that's a worry that we have. You know, we say probably around 50 languages strong and fluent and spoken and passed on. Another 50 semi-fluent, impacted, at risk, endangered. And then you've got languages that are just going through a revival process.
So colonization is kind of a polite term for what happened. So what happened?
Yes. Okay. Australia was invaded by the British. Australia was declared terra nullius, which means that it was declared as having no people. So Aboriginal people who were very definitely here were, I don't know, there's this idea that, like, they were very definitely considered not people, which kind of only puts them in the category of animal. And that's a really, like at its heart, like, that's an awful kind of thing to have to think about.
So the options were essentially assimilate or be killed.
Yes, and in a lot of cases, it's not necessarily an option so much as it's be killed. The decision is made for you.
White policy came in, stolen generation things, you know, we got mustered into missions and disciplined to not speak our languages. And, you know, that happened right across the nation where many could not speak their languages. And, you know, the impacts that colonization brought in and the diseases and so forth. People were massacred and people died from diseases and things, and you lost so much of that knowledge and that information, and language went with those who died and were impacted.
One aspect of what happened in Australia as far as colonization is the assimilation policy, and kind of in broad strokes the way that that worked was Aboriginal people were kind of rounded up, taken from their land and placed on missions. And from there, you were forced to only speak English. You couldn't teach your children your language. You couldn't teach them your culture. And as you kind of get further and further from that, the people that knew things started to die.
When colonization came in, one of the first things that we lost was our language. And they disciplined us too under white policy to not allow us to speak our language.
What kind of punishments were they delivering?
Well, you hear from people who are from Stolen Generation now where they were physically abused, you know, where people were caned for speaking their language and told verbally not to speak their language. And there's a lot of hurt and pain because that was taken away. And I see that within my own family. You know, I've had aunties of mine that were taken away from my grandmother and they could not speak with their mother, my grandmother. And the pain in their eyes. And I am privileged because I still speak my language. So I often was used as an interpreter between their own relationship, you know, their mother and daughter and a granddaughter being an interpreter in the middle.
So you can just smash the intergenerational bonds by making the language impossible.
Shatter it, absolutely, and just disconnect it. And that is pain. That's a lot of pain. And a lot of pain that generation carries. How does the next generation find the positive from those horrific stories?
And it's an oral culture. Our Aboriginal culture is oral culture. And so we don't have our own written records. We kind of are relying on what whitefellas decided was worth preserving. I think it's complicated by the fact that if you don't consider somebody a person, do you care to really record that? There were missionaries that did think that it was worth recording languages. There was two German missionaries in South Australia who did this, and they recorded something like 2,000 words and 200 phrases. And what's a little bit weird and sort of upsetting is when the Kaurna people started to reawaken their language from that archival material, there are people that will say to you how lucky you are that these German missionaries decided to, like, it's not luck. Well, I'm not particularly grateful that someone thought that my culture was worth writing down. Like, you don't get cookies for that. For considering my people, it's sort of the basic level of how you treat someone else. You respect their culture and their language. So what's written down is predominantly written down by white people, by white fellas. And so it's sort of as close an approximation as they can get. It's also why there's a lot of discussions and contention around spelling of Aboriginal languages, right down to the name of your people. So you'll come across multiple spellings of the same language group. Mine, for instance, it's a very recent thing to have Kamilaroi spelt with a G at the start. Most of my childhood, we spelt it with a K, so it was Kamilaroi. It's one of those things where, like, we are still uncovering aspects of our language as we kind of delve into finding that sort of ground of what was recorded versus what was and where is the truth.
And also trying to work out what's happening when it has been made to fit English language alphabet and phonemes.
Yes. So there's a lot of nga sounds right at the start of words, and it's like ng as in sing. We put that ng sound right at the start. So you've got like ngamale, which is see later in Kamilaroi.
That's where a lot of traditional owner groups need to sit down and work with linguists and work out a written form. So sounds, how are sounds being made, and what's the best. So with Binyara Yangunyara, we have two letter sounds, and we've got little rules that one has a trill like with R's. The letter R, so without what linguists call a retroflex, it's a trill sound. And if they are retroflex, then it's like a silent R. And there are retroflexes on letters like the L and the N, the R. And so if you've got a retroflex under there, you've got a silent R at the beginning of that letter. So there are those little rules, and those linguists have sat down and been able to, because that's the role of linguists, is to dissect our language and break it all down. And so they've worked out and said, okay, let's try and work with the English alphabet, but is that sound a j sound? Is it a ch sound? And then combining letters to make that sound. So we have two letter sounds. That is one sound, like the TJs and the NYs and the NGs and the LYs are sounds that we make in our language that using English we've been able to sort of say, okay, that's the closest sound that you're making. Use the English alphabet and we've worked out a written form. That's new generation. That's a great work that had been done by my mother and her generation, mum and dad's generation, and my generation's learning to read and write in that in our language. And it's the next generation that needs to continue on the reading and writing of our language and understanding the grammar of our language, because as speakers we don't necessarily know why we say it the way that we say it and why there are those endings and why we use suffixes and prefixes. And the next phase now is learning to be able to explain the grammar to our mob from our mob. So our own mob, own Pijanjara Yangunjara educators in the classroom teaching our Pijanjara Yangunjara students in the classroom to know grammar and structure of language, because language is slightly shifting where, and typically this is teenagers or kids getting together, creating words, which is now becoming everyday language, and that's where we're starting to see shift.
Does mean it's alive, so that's exciting.
Yes, it means that it's alive. How do we map a positive future for our next generation? How do we say to the kids that we're struggling and why are we fighting the fights of our parents and grandparents? Because that's what I'm doing right now, fighting the fight that my grandparents and parents did. How do we stop that for the next generation and say, let's just, crikey, get our shit together and move forward with a shared future and direction? And that's the story of our life as First Nations people. We're just constantly hitting brick walls and trying to sit down and work out how to either knock it down or find an alternative route. So, you know, it is a huge challenge to try and change people's perception and understanding and their ways.
You are listening to Karina Lester and Rudy Bremer, and coming up they talk about keeping the languages alive and evolving by inventing new terms, and also about how English can't handle it.
Have any languages been revived from extinction?
Yes. So Kaurna language, my understanding is that no one was speaking Kaurna a few decades ago. And then a community of Kaurna people began pulling archival material and they started going through research. Well, they started applying research practices and there's now a community of speakers. And that's like, that's incredibly impressive to actually make that commitment. And then I think a lot of people are recognizing the importance that language has on cultural identity. And so there has been a big push that's coming from a grassroots kind of position. You know, top-down policies will only get you so far. But when people are passionate and when people are interested, things start to move.
Well, we're starting to see signs around our area. Around in Adelaide, you've got parks and reserves that are co-named or named in Kaurna language, and they've set up an organisation, KWK, as well, which sort of does the business side of language, and people pay a certain fee to use a Kaurna word for a building space or a parkland or a reserve or something. So that you're starting to see presence. I came to school down here, Helen, goodness me, back in the early 90s. And the early 90s, I saw very little Kaurna language spoken or even in parklands and reserves. Living down here now, there's presence everywhere, which is amazing.
Because they decided they're not just going to preserve the language as it was, they're going to actually make it something that's practical in a contemporary Australia.
KWP, which is Kanawara Pindindi, is the organisation that works very closely with their languages. So it's really important, the work that they're doing in keeping their language, breathing, you know, oxygen into their language, and really then moving it to this next level, which is, you know, the forming of a lexicon committee who will say, okay, this is the word that we will use, the Kaurna word that we will use for a computer. So an example is that computer, and they think pretty smart, maybe it's like a lightning bolt to the brain. And so they've come up with a Kaurna word for lightning bolt to the brain, and that's the word that they use for computer. So that's the role of this organisation, KWP, and that's where language is shifting now for the Kaurna language. And so they're really at this other journey now, apart from looking at the old records, old missionary documentation, going through that translation process to now going, right, this is what we have. How do we bring in new words now as you know, things change around us, you know, technology around, social issues, cultural issues, how do we take that to the next level? So, you know, the committee is really playing a crucial role in keeping that Kaurna language alive.
I mean, every language has to come up with a word for computer.
Yes, definitely.
Generally speaking, a lot of our languages are only a few thousand words. As far as vocabulary goes, a lot of our words have multiple meanings. So in Bundjalung, which is a Central Coast of New South Wales language, the word for shoulder and tree branch and wing of a, like for a bird, is all the same word because it all kind of means the same join point.
Makes sense.
Of, yeah.
But also you're likely to know from context which one you're talking about.
Yeah. A lot of our languages have poetry to them because of that. There's a really lovely aesthetic to our languages. And I think it's why a lot of Aboriginal writers and poets are sort of the ones that are doing a huge amount of the work in maintaining the languages.
And even though English was imposed on the people, they're going to use it their own way.
We use English terms to denote family structure, but we use them in a really non-English way. In my family, and this is like, I'd say like most Aboriginal families, most Aboriginal girls are called sis until around about 10. And then after that, you start getting called your real name.
Oh, so you level up into having an individual identity.
Yeah. I never leveled up. It's now, that's my name, and I've got cousins that don't realise that I have a real name. And it's because I'm named after somebody in my family and it was too confusing to have two of us. So so instead, there's adult sis, or big sis is what they all say. So there's big sis, and then there's like 15 other sisses that are under 10. That's less confusing than two Rudies.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, I know. Normally, I'm going to use my hands a lot, so I don't know how well this will translate.
Okay.
But you'll have, let's say, for instance, a grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's got her daughter, which is your mother, and then you. And then the next thing down would be, let me see how to remember it.
You need a diagram, really.
You really do. Your mother's sisters are your mothers.
Okay.
Your father's brothers are your fathers. Your father's sisters are your aunts. Your mother's brothers are your uncles. So your mother's mothers are your grandmothers. And so all of those women are your grandmothers. And then your father's father and all of his brothers are your grandfathers. The niece and nephew thing, I think, comes in at that point. So it's so someone referring to her two older nieces. In a white context, she was talking about her father's father's sisters. So they would be her great aunts, except she doesn't call them that. One of the reasons that those family structures existed was because you've got a small group of people that are intermarrying, and you kind of have to have very particular rules about who can marry who. And it also really strongly defines what your relationship to that person is. are you a caregiver or a caretaker?
Right. So it's not like an absolute thing. It's more situational.
So you can have very young children being the grandparent of somebody older, and it is their responsibility to look after their grandchildren as much as it is the responsibility of the grandchild to look after their grandparent. There are some definitive, I'm going to get this all mucked up, but like there's some really definitive ways of viewing gender and gender roles. But like you very definitely can be a woman who has a female husband because of the way that the family line works. She'd be considered your husband. Not that you can marry her so much as she's got to treat you as a wife and you treat her as a husband in the way that you take care of each other. So like it'd be the same words, even if there's no actual like marriage that's happened. The responsibilities are the same.
And is it referring to a romantic relationship?
No. And that's where it gets, So you might be in a romantic relationship with one of her brothers, but because of who she is in sort of the structure, it's so, it really doesn't work without diagrams.
Like so many interpersonal things.
But yeah, so there's this idea of like we've probably got one of the most complicated interpersonal relationships I've ever encountered. I don't know. Maybe I just don't know enough about other cultures though.
I don't know. Maybe you really did win on the complicated family structures.
But in and of that, we've got like words that denote those relationships. So like if we didn't have to use English to explain these, it'd be so much easier. You'd actually follow a little bit more. Theoretically.
Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is haplology. Noun. The omission of one occurrence of a sound or syllable which is repeated within a word. For example, in February, pronounced February. Try using haplology in an email today. One for you, Ologies Podcast. Today you heard from Rudy Brenner and Karina Lester. Karina Lester is a linguist at the University of Adelaide and co-manager and senior Aboriginal language worker of the university's mobile language team. Find out more about their work with communities to maintain languages and culture at mobilelanguageteam.com.au. Rudy Brenner is a radio broadcaster and producer with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Her work includes Radio National's Away, featuring Aboriginal arts and culture across Australia, the show Word Up, capturing words from Indigenous languages, and Little Yarns, an award-winning show for kids and parents to learn about Australia's many Indigenous languages. And her latest project is the show Thin Black Line, an investigation into the death of an Aboriginal teenager in police custody. All of these shows are available in the podcast apps, so get in there. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman, with help from Ian Steadman and Rudy Brenner. The Illusionist music is by Martin Austwick of palebirdmusic.com. Find the show on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook at Illusionist Show, and become a supporter at patreon.com/illusionist if you'd like extra content such as me melting down. And to hear or read every episode of The Illusionist, see the full dictionary entries for the randomly selected words, find links to all the guests and further information about each topic, browse the lexicon of all the words covered in the show, you can visit the show's forever home, theillusionist.org.
In my experience, Indigenous languages in Australia don't really have a word for that finite idea of goodbye. Our words tend to mean sort of, I'll see you again, so, or we'll see you later. Depending on the language, there might be a bit of a tonal kind of influence about whether you're flagging that you're not sure when you'll see somebody again, but there is always this sort of feeling that we will. So in Gadigal, which is where we are recording, in Gadigal country, they say Welama. In my country, we say Ngamale. So yeah, I'll end with Ngamale.